Eric the Blacksmith is here, and you know what that means. It's another Phantasms of Freedom, and this one is number 14, believe it or not. Hello, Eric.
Hey, Al. Good to be back.
Yeah. And,
14.
14. Now, did you catch that little thing I did with the 13? You had said, where did the time go, and what did I intro with?
Where did the time go?
Poco, yep. Anyway.
Yep.
Nice. And you're going to hit with one last autumnal song on our outro that, once again, will be by Poco. And I'm telling you this ahead of time, and that's called Harvest Moon. Great, great autumn song, and then we'll be done with the seasonal stuff.
That is a good song.
You were pretty loaded for bear when you emailed me earlier in the week and then just again today. We're probably not going to get through everything, but the stuff that you have come upon, it's thick and it's good, and I'm going to turn it over to you because you know exactly where you're going, and it's pretty interesting.
Okay, Al, yeah. I was looking at the situation today with Obamacare, the situation we've got with so many problems with the budget and just all the myriad entanglements we have almost everywhere you look. And I was thinking about it, and I asked myself, where did all this begin? I really had to ask, where did this begin? I mean, it couldn't have just popped out of, you know, some hole in the ground a week and a half ago.
But Eric,
it starts somewhere.
Eric, what do you mean by where? What's this? Where did this begin? What do you mean by this?
What I mean by this is the problems that we have as a nation. And everybody's talking about getting back to something, getting this back, getting that back, the Constitution, for example. And then I thought about it, and as I've said before, what they want is something that's caused the problem all along, the Constitution. And there is a particular part of the Constitution that really is the crux of the situation, and that is, wait for it, the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause of the Constitution was pretty much the lever, the fulcrum, that these guys have used, the elites, over the decades and the centuries, to basically get whatever they want. The Commerce Clause is probably the basis for 80%, 75 to 80% of all the regulations and all the suppressions that we have in our landscape today.
All right, again, let me ask you this to try to delineate, and I'm sure you're going to go there anyway. But I think back to the Iron Man, as you well do, too, and what I'm asking you in this case is that the Constitution may not get really specific about what it allows, but I think therein lies the problem, that it's very open-ended, and it's more or less, well, guys, do what you can do under the umbrella. Have a day.
Well, yes, it was very, it was almost schizophrenic in a sense, that there's a part in here, and I have to say, this book by Royce is a treasure trove, Hologram of Liberty. It's a bloody treasure trove.
I tell you
what, it's got so much information in it.
Why don't you state the whole nine yards now? Because although we put it in the credits, who knows who reads that? But why don't you just state that again in case people are going, what was that again?
Okay. The book is called Hologram of Liberty, the Constitution's Shocking Alliance with Big Government, and it's by Kenneth W. Royce. He's an author who's done other books. He's a firearms enthusiast. He's written books about your involvements with the police if you happen to get stopped, what to look out for, what to avoid, etc., and other books as well. He's written some novels. There's two editions. The first edition is shorter. It came out around 96, 97. This edition came out last year and has quite a bit of added material to it. And in here, he has a chapter called 10th Amendment versus Commerce Clause. And one of the statements here is regarding the Articles of Confederation. And if you look at the word delegated, okay, and I'll read a section from the Articles. Article 2, from the Articles of Confederation. Each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. Okay. Now, if you look at the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, okay, the Articles were 1781, Constitution 1791, the power is not and they omitted the word expressly. They said delegated. They just said delegated. The power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. All right. The 10th Amendment was supposed to save the people in the states from this creeping totalitarianism. And, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of Jefferson. He did write something here. Quote, the leading object of the Constitution was to leave with the states all authorities which respected their own citizens only, and to transfer to the United States those which respected citizens of foreign or other states, to make us several as to ourselves, but one as to all others. So basically, the states were left alone for several years. It pretty much worked out until the Marshall Court, 1801. And then you had McCulloch versus Maryland, which really sort of poured on the implied powers ruling. This was in 1819. And this is when a lot of the ambiguities and the, you know, you might want to nail jello to the wall characteristics of the Constitution finally began to be seized upon by the founding fraudsters and a lot of the Federalists and banksters in the mix.
Seized upon, they're the ones that created it so they could do it.
Oh, well, of course. They created it so they could later seize upon it. Okay? And this case, McCulloch versus Maryland, it was 17 U.S. 315, 404, and this was 1819. And what he says in here, or what, you know, the Supremes did say in this case was pretty revealing. A constitution to contain an accurate detail of all the subdivisions of which its great powers will admit, and of all the means by which they may be carried into execution, would partake of the prolixity of a legal code and could scarcely be embraced by the human mind. It would probably never be understood by the public. Its nature, therefore, requires that only its great outlines should be marked, its important objects designated, and the minor ingredients which compose those objects be deduced from the nature of the objects themselves, unquote. So it's almost like they're saying, well, trust us to make the deductions. And if the Constitution, if it had been sold to the nation as this great outline, you know, of government's nature and that these ingredients could be deduced by some future Supreme Court, these Hamiltonian jokers would have been laughed right out of the ratification debates.
Okay.
But what they did was they were very slick. They were very subtle. And I'm beginning to realize, well, I've realized it for a bit now, that Hamilton knew he couldn't get everything he wanted in one fell swoop. But what he did was he set in motion something that would slowly evolve or devolve over time to what we have today. And I believe fully, in my heart of hearts, I believe that he knew that.
Well, I'm sure he did. Well, I'm sorry, Eric, but I mean, you know, this strikes me as I'm thinking about, you know, his whole life and such. I wonder how, I mean, this is where you wonder about, did a wild card event still kind of insinuate its big ass into history? And that is, considering we know that there's handlers, although probably less at that time than there were now, and probably most of them were across the ocean, did anybody foresee the fact that Burr wanted to kick his ass? So I'm thinking, how much more would he have done if he had lived? And I'm going to throw that to you because, I mean, I don't know if you thought about that in those terms, not that you need to do that, but I think, you know, Hamilton was a son of a bitch when it comes to we the little people, but he got a lot done, like you said, and knew it would happen. He had to know because he was doing the bidding of his masters.
Right, and I've said this, that I believe that it should correctly be said that Hamilton was truly the father of this country, not Washington.
And, all right, now be specific. Why would you say that?
because I believe that Hamilton, I mean, Washington had sort of more of an overall view of things, where Hamilton, they say the devil's in the details. I think if Washington had the had something he wanted to do, I'm convinced that Washington really, he had sort of a more of a, I don't know, he was more of a gentrified individual, whereas Hamilton was extremely educated and knew the details of the law like very few people did.
All right, now understand, I'm with you on that. I was not being a devil's advocate, because I believe, all right, now here's where I'll lay it out. I think that Washington knew exactly what the deal was. He let Hamilton play bad cop. He played good cop. But I think that, I mean, heck, by the time that Burr greased Hamilton, Washington was already retired. So what I'm saying is that you're talking about the father of the country. I'm with you on that 100%. Washington goes out and tries to sell the crap as a president, which is nothing more than a what would you say, is a PR person. And, yes, the devil's in the details, and Hamilton was the devil in the details.
Well, and what I mean is, okay, Washington, for example, the whole situation with the districts, he saw a situation was getting out of control, particularly we had, you know, the Whiskey Rebellion. And I wouldn't be surprised, of course, I don't know this for sure, but I really wouldn't be surprised, Al, if he came to Alex and said, Alex, what the hell do I do here? How do I deal with this situation? And chances are Hamilton either sat down, you know, and considered a few things and mused and ruminated, and or he talked to his bankster friends, which could be one reason for all his trips back and forth to Philadelphia that I'd mentioned in a previous installment, all his furtive goings, comings and goings.
Yeah.
And it could very well be that he was getting instructions on the finer points of law, the finer points of legal maneuvers on how to set this up, either in conformance with what the king wanted, or just basically to protect his speculation buddies.
All right, now, I'm sorry, go ahead, finish your thought, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, yeah, and I really do believe that sort of Washington had a macroscopic view and Hamilton had a microscopic view in the details. Somebody once said that beware of people who could dream concretely. And of anybody, Hamilton had the ability to dream concretely.
All right. How about if I give you this scenario? I'm not going to beat it to the ground. I just want to throw it out to you and ask you if it's plausible. Knowing that already there was some kind of impetus and some kind of force brought down upon the elites, it may not have been palpable, and who knows if it was or wasn't, but it may not have been palpable to the new citizens of the several states that had just been confederated, though they didn't want it. But what about the fact that Washington, like I said, plays good cop, or at least sells the bad cabbage? And in the meantime, cats like Hamilton and Jefferson and the others start getting down to what it's really going to be like while Washington goes out there and does the yada yada.
Well, there is an excerpt of a letter that Washington sent to Hamilton. Basically, Washington, he would send Hamilton out to do these things, and you know, it was on the face of it disharmonious. But Washington said in a letter to Hamilton, basically said, you know, I'm really sad you're not here. I miss you.
Mm-hmm.
When are you coming back? When can we team up again? And I'm trying to find that letter, that excerpt. It's I have it somewhere in my notes here. But yeah, there was an element of internal strife. I'm sure that any cabinet's going to have that. I do recall that there was more of a friction between Adams and Jefferson. Of course, they did reconcile later on. They wrote letters to each other for a long time, there was more of a friction between Hamilton and Adams. But Washington and Hamilton were pretty much on the same page.
Yeah, well, that's my point. I mean,
yeah,
you know, there could be letters and correspondences. That's all there is from that time. But it also can be something where it's like given as Exhibit A, and they knew it was going to be provided as Exhibit A so that they could cover their tracks. That's why I'm not trusting any of those son of a bitches. And any frictions they might have had, well, they might have been some, But all of those first presidents, at least up to Van Buren, knew exactly who they were paying homage to and had to more or less arrange things in the new United States to satisfy certain parties across the, you know, the pond. I know that's very vague, but, of course, I am suspicious of any of them now because, as we said, you can read the correspondences, you can read, you know, biographers, you know, glowing remarks about them, but we expect that as PR. The point is, when we look at their actions and what they did and didn't do, can we actually get a very realistic profile of all these characters? So you're telling me then, Eric, that you think that Washington and Hamilton were very much on the same page. I believe it, but I think Hamilton kind of like acted like, oh, well, you know, Hamilton and the other guys, I couldn't, you know, they were really strong and they got the bank pushed through. I couldn't do anything about it. Bullshit.
Right.
All right, now, wait a minute. Were you up in your attic or what?
Oh, no, I was just... No, it's... I was shutting the door. The wife just got home, so I just wanted to...
Yeah, keep her out by all means. Yes, we can't have that.
Yeah, and the cats, too. I didn't want them coming in and out and scraping in the litter boxes and everything out, so I figured it would be a little quieter with the door shut.
Okay. How's that working out so far?
So far, so good.
All right, so when I was back at it, I mean, I think that Hamilton and Washington were a two-headed hydra, and Hamilton, you know, did... the work necessary, and Washington just went, oh, guffaw, you know, well, you know.
Exactly. I mean, Washington, he did not have the education that Hamilton had. And I really honestly don't get the impression that Washington was the sharpest knife in the drawer. I mean, yes, he had a lot of practical experience. He certainly had the battlefield experience. He certainly knew his surveying and things like that. But as far as the actual fine points of the law, the real heavy research and the jots and the tittles, I think he left a lot of that stuff to Hamilton.
So can we look at least at the first president as we understand it after, you know, the Articles of Confederation with the way of Nickel Candy? Can we look at that, though, really as the very beginning of the whole hypocrisy of the presidency, and that is, give us somebody we can elect and we'll take care of the policy?
Sure.
Okay.
Yep. There was an interesting book, Understanding the Constitution, by a guy named J.W. Peltison, right? And he talks about the Tenth Amendment. And he said, quote, "This amendment was adopted to assuage fears, and it does not alter the distribution of powers between the national and state governments. It adds nothing to the Constitution. The court has returned to Marshall's view that the Tenth Amendment and the reserve powers of the states do not limit the national government in exercising the powers given to it by the Constitution. Today, it makes no constitutional difference whether or not an act of Congress touches or governs matters otherwise subject to state regulation." So, you know, you look at the Tenth Amendment, and in the debates, they talked about it. In fact, it was the 18th of August, 1789. You had South Carolina, anti-federalists, Thomas Tudor, Tucker. And I might have mentioned this in a previous installment, but I'll say that this time it moves that amendment reserving powers not delegated to the states be changed to read powers not expressly delegated. So Madison objected. He says, it's impossible to confine a government to the exercise of express powers. There must necessarily be admitted powers by implication unless the Constitution descended to recount every minutia. The motion is defeated. So it seems to me as though it's a heads they win, tails we lose. Because for us, it has to be expressly outlined. For them, it can, okay, here it is. Federal powers are implicitly construed while their limitations must be explicit.
Okay, you know what? It's like, what does that mean? Compared to what? You know what I mean?
It's the powers of versus the limitations on. basically what it did was it put the handcuffs on us. It took the handcuffs off them.
Well, who's us? The states?
The states and the people.
Right. And them being the federal government.
Yes.
All right. Let me just interject at this time in case anybody wants to, like, apply that to what's happening today. Now, I mean, long before you and I ever met, I was laughing at all the jerk-offs that, you know, every so often will come up with, well, New Hampshire's going to secede. Vermont's going to secede. Oklahoma's going to secede. Nobody's seceding, assholes. Nobody's doing that. The reason why is because the Constitution corralled all the states under a federated government. Now, you can ask, well, what about the Civil War? Well, first of all, I'm really, you know, I find it curious that that was allowed to run, but I think that was allowed to go because it's better to let, you know, something run its course and kill it than to suppress it forever. So before and certainly after the Civil War, there's going to be no state seceding because they are a party to the contract known as the Constitution. Now, I've said a lot about that, and Eric, if you find that in error or, you know, you feel differently, please say so. But that's, I mean, that's why when all I hear about these secessionist movements, like, get lost. It's not going to happen.
I think the only way there could be a successful secessionary movement would be if the government itself of this country was to undergo a thermodynamic breakdown, total thermodynamic breakdown, where basically no troops could be called in, that the situation in this country would have to become so so rotten and so shitty that it would almost the system would collapse of its own weight.
Well, but my point is then, if you have that situation, you have anarchy, so there's nothing going on anyway.
No, and that's pretty much the only thing that would lead to secession.
But then,
other than that, it's not going to happen.
But then everybody could go their separate way because there's a breakdown and everything goes. My point is that if you have a solvent federal government, as we have right now, for whatever, you know, that means, they're not going to allow any secessionist movements. And if you have if you have a secessionist situation, it's because everything's broken down in D.C. and you're basically wild in the streets.
That's correct. That's the only way I think we'd see secession in the United States.
Because the whole idea, and this goes back to what we're talking about, I mean, not to hang on it as the only situation, but it seems to be the one court case that just absolutely solidifies and kernelizes exactly what the deal is with the Constitution, and that is people cannot use the Constitution as a remedy. Only the states can, because the states are a party to the Constitution and private citizens aren't. So when you become a state, you've got yourself locked into the Federation under the central government. So my point is that you're not going to do anything that the federal government doesn't want you to do. And if you do it, you're going to get your ass kicked, which is what happened basically between 61 and 65 in the 19th century.
That's correct.
All right.
And it's the way the states, you know, it seems as though they voluntarily, one would think, at least on the face of it, we know, of course, this is different. They didn't voluntarily join because look what happened with Rhode Island. But it seems like the history books have said, well, they voluntarily joined the Union, so couldn't they voluntarily leave? Well, the truth is they didn't voluntarily join. You know, when Washington threatened in 1790 or 1791, we're going to boycott and we're going to embargo your ass unless you sign on. You know, from the very start, this whole thing was basically it was a strong arm tactic.
Yeah. So where's the freedom? You know. And JQ from his side of the street, not that he was a proponent of it, but he gave us information to the effect that the elites and those who were in the circles with Hamilton and the boys and all that were like, all those people who were rebelling are just ruffians, and they're basically, I mean, I didn't use the word anarchist then, but it's like they were just, you know, turning out just for the pleasure of just throwing everything up in the air, which is like, of course, what we should remember is the way media is today, because it's always been under government control.
Yeah.
So, in fact, what JQ recitated in, I forget what kind of works, whether it was Furnow's or others, I think it was from the characters from Harvard, They were, you know, they just made fun of Rhode Islanders as just being ruffians and, you know, nowhere people who are just like basically assholes. So
sure,
I'm like,
it was
okay. What?
Oh, I was just going to say that, yeah, the assholes who knew better and voted down the Constitution by a ratio of 11 to 1.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, like, I look at you know, Freno's Circle and those guys is basically your Rush Limbaugh. You know?
That's a good analogy.
Oh, God.
You know, if we go back and look at the rationale for the Constitution, Al, this, you know, exigency that caused this whole convention was, you know, a manufactured crisis of commerce between the states, really, if you look at it. And every history book is in agreement with this. You know, and if you look at the official story, you know, the states were these sovereigns. They were squabbling and fighting amongst themselves. You know, they would get into tariff wars with each other, and they'd, you know, prevent the emergency of a true nation. So, you know, and hence remained at risk from these other, you know, European countries, of course, and the native, you know, the indigenous peoples. Of course, we had the tariff wars, but I don't know if it was as big a crisis as they blew it up for everybody to believe. And I think that's one thing that the Federalists in their Federalist Papers really played up on. It was Hegelian dialectic, you know, writ large.
But, you know, you bring up a good point, and this brings back to where you started. So in all fairness to you, wherever I may have taken this, this is the way you entered into this particular segment, and that is commerce. It's all about the business.
Yes.
And the Federation of the States was all about transacting between the states and Europe or whoever the other contracting parties were in commerce. It's all about the money, and that's why the Constitution centralized everything so that Europe, especially Britain, didn't have to screw around with 13 countries. They wanted to deal with the central government.
Correct.
All right. And so the Commerce Clause, people are like, well, that's only got to do with business. Oh, folks, don't be stupid as I was. Understand that the way of the world has been, is now, and always will be about the money.
And I'd like to get more into that, and I have some more things to reveal on that. And, of course, I said this before, Al, the business of America is business.
Yeah, that's all
always
that
been that
yeah.
way.
Show me the money.
And yeah. And here's, okay, let's look at Article 1, Section 10, Clause 2 of the U.S. Constitution. No state shall, without the consent of the Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws, unquote. Now, let's ask ourselves, if the point of the Constitution was to shit-can the tariff issues, that clause alone would have sufficed. You know, but that's not what Hamilton and Madison had in mind. They didn't want that. They wanted the new government to regulate commerce. You know, they wanted a power that would go far beyond nationalization of tariffs. So that what they did in that case was they threw in this little sally here. And this was Article Section 8, Clause 3 of the U.S. Constitution. The Congress shall have power to regulate commerce among the several states. Game, set, match, right there.
Okay, and just please articulate why that was the whole...
Well, it was wholly unnecessary, really. And that's probably one of the biggest smoking guns. This was basically the underpinning, this was the foundation that was placed underneath a lot of the regulations that we see now.
All right.
Even the anti-federalists didn't see this back then.
All right.
But it was dormant until it was activated in the 30s. This is when it really came online, was in the 20s and 30s of the 20th century.
All right. Bear with me. Will you just read that again?
Sure. The Congress shall have power to regulate commerce among the several states.
All right.
Right there.
All right. Now, what I read into that is that nobody's doing any business unless it passes through the central government.
That's right. Bingo. There
so,
it is.
Yeah. So Massachusetts can't go do something with France, and South Carolina can't do something, with Germany. it's got to go through the central government. And to this day, it's always been that way. You know, with the
yes, it has.
Right, with FTC and the FCC and all that other stuff. So,
and what they did was they put in so much fog, and they put basically what they put in so many imprecise clauses, and so the Constitution, the word, Al, that I think of when I think of the Constitution, I think of one word: nebulous.
It can be whatever you want it to be.
Exactly. The whole thing is so nebulous as to be virtually unfathomable, in that you can't really nail it down to any specific meaning or intent.
But that was, I mean, that was also
that
what
was
Montgomery and Iman were trying to tell us, and what you've come to that conclusion is the same as we all have, and that is, oh, well, it's a living document. It can mean anything. You know, no, bullshit. What it really means is that it's so nebulous that whoever's in power can make it do whatever they want it to do. They can make it like, you can make it bark like a dog or meow like a cat, and us, the little people, are going to have to sit up and do whatever they tell us to do.
That's right. Meow like a cat, bark like a dog, or chirp like a bird.
Yeah.
Or anything in between.
Yeah, and that's why I have to laugh, because they always turn around and go, I mean, I bought into this as well, and I'm sure you did too, and that
yes.
is, you know, we get into the idea about, well, it's such a living document that's allowed people, I mean, I'm just sorry I didn't go and puke in the bathroom when they started that crap 20 years ago. No, it's, you know what it is? It's bullshit, and it's always meant to be bullshit, and they can make the bullshit do whatever they want to.
Yes. Well, and the thing is, they really wanted to nail down, you know, it's sort of a mixophore here, they wanted to nail down their elastic or implied powers. So they threw in another clause. This was Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18 of the Constitution.
You mean it gets
and
worse?
This one's,
it gets worse.
Yeah, it gets worse, Al.
All right.
To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. That's almost as bad as notwithstanding. Okay, and then, you know, the 1791 tussle over the first bank, you know, Hamilton and Jefferson, they were arguing, you know, they were going back and forth like a bad argument over the latitude of the word necessary. And they both got it right that the future of the country really was based on the outcome. And the bank, you know, it wasn't explicitly nor implicitly authorized in the Constitution. The bank was. You know, it really, it's kind of hard to say if the bank was really allowed. You know, it's another one of those nebulous characteristics of this thing.
All right, what I understood was this, and I'm not an expert on this, and we need not, you know, spend a lot of time on, I'm just going to throw this out. And that is, as far as my feeble understanding of all this, because after a while it's like, okay, you know how I am. I'm like, all right, what's the deal? So, but we had a Treasury Department and all this other jazz, but we had Congress in charge of certain things, like, remember, what does it say in the, I forget what article it is, that Congress is in charge with evaluating the currency?
Yes. Well, let's see, what was it? Determining the value thereof, issuing coins and currency,
yeah,
and determining the value thereof.
All right, now that's fine. And what did they do in 1913? They gave it to the Federal Reserve, which is unconstitutional, but it was never tried.
Right.
Congress went ahead and took what was a part of their office and gave it away to a private concern, which was not allowed in the Constitution, but it was never tried, and we have the Federal Reserve to this day. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So, I mean, when you say what's necessary, yeah, all these words, and that's another thing that I may try to drive home, to the point where it gets kind of boring, because when you get involved in that kind of syntax, it's like, all right, it's like an English class, leave me alone. But you have to understand that. And he did the wet work into that. I mean, we owe him a great debt. But you have to understand that they use terms, and they are loopholes through which elephants can run through, but if you and I try to, as we the little people, all of a sudden it get pulled tight that you couldn't get a, you know, a moat through it.
That's correct. And
what the hell is a moat?
He did go. What's that?
What the hell is a moat? I thought that sounded good.
I did too. He was saying that the word necessary meant necessary. This was Jefferson. So what does Hamilton do? He writes a 15,000-word rebuttal to Jefferson and say he said that it meant expedient or helpful. That Jefferson's definition would be to give it the same force as if absolutely had been prefixed to it. So you basically got Hamilton wordsmithing from the start.
But, you know, Jefferson was a hypocrite anyway.
Oh, of course he was.
But what makes it the whole thing so much more interesting is that it was Burr, his vice president, that killed Hamilton. So, you know, how do you sit in that whole thing? You know?
Yeah, just strange bedfellows, politics.
Damn.
So, you know, the states, they weren't told about this ambiguity. You know, everything kind of went along during the ratification debates, and they were kept in the dark. You know, you had Madison in Federalist Paper 39. You know, he went out of his way to basically lie and say that this proposed system wasn't going to be detrimental to state sovereignty or states or people's rights. So he writes, quote, "The powers delegated to the proposed Constitution are few and defined." Bullshit. That was my little word. "Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. Federal jurisdiction extends to certain enumerated subjects only and leaves to the several states a residuary and inviolable sovereignty over all other subjects." So, you know, you can kind of get the clue that these clowns were disingenuous from the start, because if you look at the language, you know, Article 1, let's see, Section 8, I'm sorry, Article 1, Article 1, Section 10, Clause 2, restricting the states with absolutely necessary, okay, and now they take Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, and they only restrict Congress with a mere necessary. So they're laying a lot of extra weight and cement on the states. All right, states, you've got to jump through a hell of a lot more hoops than the federal government does. And that was basically put right in the Constitution.
But are we not looking at a point where, all right, again, I'm not going to get into the whole idea of like, well, the Articles of Confederation could not last, blah, blah. I don't care. All right, fine, that's good. But the way that would change was not good, and that set a precedent, I think, for the kind of duplicity that what we call the federal government conducted. Considering the fact that those individuals that went down to Philadelphia to swap out the Articles of Confederation for the Constitution were not elected. All right, be that as it may. But, I mean, aren't we – what we're looking at from the very beginning is some kind of – I mean, silent coup, if you will, that – I mean, wouldn't you love to have seen what people were thinking or heard or read – what people were thinking about in the 13 states, saying, "What are we doing? Oh, we're going to be, you know, consolidated like we were in counties over in the UK."
Well, that's exactly what the revolution was ostensibly fought over, was to achieve the same structure that was existing in the Articles of Confederation. That's really what the people wanted, and all they would have had to do was to put that Article 1, Section 10, Clause 2. In the Articles of Confederation, which probably would have worked. You had Patterson, he came out with the New Jersey Compromise, which basically would have made the United States' system operate much the way the Swiss system does.
What are you saying, with cantons dealing with other countries?
Pretty much, cantons dealing with cantons, and the states pretty much would have been akin to cantons.
All right. And
in,
I mean,
how they interact with each other. And that was the New Jersey plan that was put forth by Patterson.
Okay.
And I'll read this again. Article 1, Section 10, Clause 2. "No state shall, without the consent of the Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports, except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws." Now, if they just tacked that into the Articles of Confederation, they probably could have solved a lot of problems right there. But obviously they didn't, because that wasn't the plan. And I even called my local radio show yesterday.
You bugged that guy again?
Oh yeah, I was. He had a commandant from the Coast Guard Academy on, and he was talking with Lee. And I decided to stir the pot a little bit, so I called up and I talked about the anti-federalists and how Washington, you know, threatened Rhode Island with an ass kicking if they didn't behave. And I honestly don't know whether they knew whether to shit or go blind, and I kind of got hustled off the air real quick, and, you know, they kind of hubba-da-hubba-da, and went to another subject. And it just tells me that it's the myth. It's, Al, I think of fractals.
What?
Pebbles to mountains. You know, it's basically fractals. There was a good definition I had of it, found of it.
Well, you started it. You better find it.
I will. All right.
Fractal?
A fractal is an object or quantity that displays self-similarity in a somewhat technical sense on all scales. The object need not exhibit exactly the same structure at all scales, but the same type of structure must appear on all scales. Okay. So let's look at it. Pebbles. Two mountains. Pretty similar structures, obviously far different scales. Water droplets to seas. All right, let's look now at backroom dealings and principalities. I think of fractals.
You're scaring me, Eric.
You know, and there was a great line that I saw. I can't find it. I cannot find it. You know, in other words, little conspiracies, big conspiracies, the only thing different is the scale. The structure is pretty much the same. I saw this picture of these little water flows on a beach, and if you looked at them, you could have sworn they were rivers taken from 3,000 feet up.
All right.
That's all I'm saying.
What you're talking about is the altering of perception.
Sure.
But that's what deception is all about.
Thank you.
No, I mean, we have all been walking around, you know, trying to speak with people or at least, speak with people and introduce the fact that, you know, we Americans are subjects of propaganda. And, you know, and what is patriotism? I mean, the whole nine yards. It's like, what do you mean? What do I owe patriotism? You're not my mom. You're not my dad. Screw you. What do you know, you're nothing except some kind of corporation. All right, blah, 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 blah. But that's what we're dealing with. And in this late stage, I guess we can call it, you know, folks like you and others that, you know, somewhat are centered around what I've done in others. I mean, it's not at all treacherous or treasonous. It's just saying, let's take a look at exactly what's going on. And that's something that none of us have done. And, I mean, I'm included in that, too. I spent, 40, 50 years with blinders on?
How much? Same here.
Yeah, all right. So you take a look at other people and you mention something to them, and if they flip out, you can kind of understand. I can't remember how I took things when something was introduced, although I know a lot of what happened to me, as you well know. I mean, I was really young when I heard it. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. But
well, you know.
Good.
I was going to say, similar things happened to me when I was a kid. You know, my dad would go fishing, and he'd hook up with his buddies, a number of them who fought in Korea and fought in Vietnam. I mean, you know, you've got about 7-8 years on me. And I would hear them, you know, they would maybe go fishing and come into the dock, and, you know, I'd be in the back of the boat, and, you know, I'd be along for the ride. And, you know, they'd have a few beers and, they'd get loosened up a bit. And I'd hear things about, you know, the defense in the Navy and Vietnam that just didn't quite jive with what I learned in school. So it's kind of a similar situation to what you heard with your dad.
And that brings us to where we're at this very moment, while you're on one end of the phone and I am on the other. And that is, we're not trying to eviscerate or undermine any, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, nation?
No, of course not.
But, you know, the other hand is this, and that is, you know, what is the relationship between us being brought up in this country and any kind of fealty to that country? I mean, what do you want to do with me? And I think we saw that through the last wars with Vietnam especially. And then
we used tactical nukes in Vietnam.
Well, the point is, and that is, why we are there. What is this all about? And, I mean, that was my, you know, last, I guess, Rubicon in that, you know, I was so much for the Vietnam War in 1960 when I was 9, you know, and I was still into it when I was 14. And then all of a sudden I'm going to graduate high school and that thing is still going on. And now I'm starting to wonder, like, what is the problem here, folks? I mean, this thing has gone on for like, what, from 1960 through 69? I mean,
yeah, our end of it. I mean, the French, when were they?
The French, you know, the French got out of there before we even started. Yeah.
Right, 53, 54. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so I mean, so.
And it goes right back to the mercantilistic state. This is what the founders really wanted. They wanted a mercantilistic state protected by a national government, you know, in basically in full control of the gun and the bank. But, you know, a number of people didn't want that. So what could they do? They could get this scheme over time. Work with the federal judges, and they themselves designing the rules of the game, they were destined to win. And guess what? All of it's constitutional.
Yeah, then the question I would ask you is, what isn't? You know, it's whatever you want it to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, all right, I don't really want to go from this, but, I mean, I would just say this. I mean, everybody's upset about Obama, who's just another, you know, toy like Shrub Bush was. He's a little bit harder to take down, not because he's black, just because he's an asshole. yeah, I mean, and Bush was an asshole, too, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, it just gets harder and harder to, like, brook when you look at all this stuff. But the thing is that, you know, you hear all these, like, this hubbub about war powers and all this other stuff. But the thing is, in the bottom line is, folks, you people who yak about the Constitution, when necessarily did you ever use it? Well, they can say, well, I never had to because that was a shield. Oh, really? Well, if you went ahead and did something that was not necessarily, shall we say, in the national acceptability zone, what kind of protection did you have then? And that's why I'm doing this show with Theo, and that's because suppressed history has been suppressed because the powers that be do not want you to understand that there was another side of this discussion, that it was always about this. And that's what you brought us out of, Eric, and that is, from the very beginning, it was a pretty imperial, shall we say, dictatorial set up, even though we had this Constitution and the branches of bullshit.
Yeah. You know, you had to be given this, you had to give the Congress these sweeping powers, but it had to be simplistically put. So the courts and judges down the road could interpret this any way they wanted. These guys were brilliant. I mean, I look at just how brilliant this is, and I'm thinking of the Principalities Clause. I'm almost saying to myself, just mere men couldn't come up with something this genius, this diabolically brilliant plan.
All right. No, I'm with you on that, but please, can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, I go back to the nature of the world, the kingdoms, when Christ was presented with the kingdoms of the world by Satan. And he could have, you know, he could have had anything he wanted. And he told to Satan, just, you know, pound sand, get out of here.
Satan told him, I run these countries.
Yeah, like we've talked about before. I think it was a very good observation that somebody made when they said past, present, and future. It wasn't just then. These were all the kingdoms for all time. And then I look at just... Okay, I'm going to get into here's where to me the Luciferian aspect of this really does manifest itself.
Go for it, because I know this is a nettlesome problem, but you know, too bad for those who can't heal, you know, deal with it.
So. Yeah. Look at the suppressed inventions and the suppressed cures, which have been deemed okay. Let's look at Obamacare very briefly. The Commerce Clause was one of the primary methods the Supremes used to declare it constitutional. Let's look at, and you and Mike in the last show talked about suppressed cancer cures. Did you know that there was a guy named Harry Hoxie? This guy was a coal miner. He had a family herbal recipe. And he was claiming an 80% cure rate. His great-grandfather back in the 1830s, 1840s, noticed that a stallion of his was very sick and dying, and he experimented with this stallion, put him basically out in the field to die. And this stallion, I mean, here's the wisdom of animals. I mean, how much we can learn from them. This horse started eating herbs and plants that weren't part of its normal diet. So in about 3 weeks, this tumor that this horse had started to stabilize. Well, a year goes by, and this horse is well. So old man Hoxie takes a look at these herbs that this horse was eating, and he started to put them together, formulate them, mix them, grind them, and all this, and experiment on other animals because he was a veterinarian, in addition to being a farmer, I suppose. And Harry Hoxie's father, you know, obviously the grandfather's son, was passed this recipe and gave the recipe to Harry on his deathbed with the promise Harry had to make to him that this cure would be available to anybody who needed it, regardless of whether he could pay for it or not. Okay, so this was in 1924, his first clinic. Did you know, Al, that he had clinics in 17 states by the mid-50s? And he had an 80% cure rate. Now, I look at my town here in East Lyme.
Well, wait a minute. Let's clarify this without using chemo or radiation, right?
This was an herbal formula.
That's completely homeopathic.
Completely homeopathic. Yes, correct. My apologies for not mentioning that.
All right.
Completely homeopathic. He was claiming an 80% cure rate. Okay. Now, it got to the point where he would, in fact, there was some of the newspaper articles, and there's a wonderful documentary out, and I will provide a link to it. Cancer, The Hidden Cures. And then there was another one, Hoxie, When Healing Becomes a Crime, or How Healing Becomes a Crime. He did a demonstration in front of 50,000 people, I believe it was in Texas, because that's where Hoxie was based. And there are photographs that I saw. You could see this was in the 30s. There was a guy who had a tumor on his skull. Hoxie collected 50,000 people so he could demonstrate this cure. And the headline of this article says, Hoxie Cures Cancer in Front of 50,000. And I see the pink ribbons.
I know.
The walks, the quarter marathons. In fact, my wife and I have a good friend who just participated in one. And, you know, if I know somebody and they want to do something like that, I'll support them. You know, they believe in what they're doing. I don't necessarily go along with it. I have told friends about this.
Right.
But I'm not going to be, I mean, you know, at what point do I just throw my hands up in the air and say, how much can one person do?
With regard to those around you who are doing what they do,
yeah,
you know, I mean, I'm not
like
ordering
kind of
anything.
Killjoy.
Well, I mean, I'll give them that. I know, like I said, I've backed them, and then you just walk away. Because, like, you know, you've heard on this show, we may have talked about this before, and that is, I mean, when do you realize that this is not doing anything? I mean, that the American Cancer Society, whatever the hell it is, I mean, just keeps going on and on and on. And then, but here's the other thing. You have to realize that other countries are dealing this in a different way. And, of course, then you get, you know, everybody that comes out on the Internet about, oh, this is voodoo shit and all this other stuff. Look, here's the point. And this is something that innocently my wife and I came to probably around 2000. And it was a horrid realization for me to come to. Because, I mean, I always trusted the medical, you know, pharmaceutical, you know, hospital iron triangle. And I looked at my wife and I said, you know what? There is no profit in healthy people. And we just started with that. And then, you know, honestly, before anything happened politically or otherwise with me and conspiracy stuff and blah, 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 we looked at that and, you know, we said, that's chilling. And you know what? It's right.
The control of the medical scene. Back in the 1800s, you had the empiricists and you had the allopaths, and they were both on pretty equal footings. You know, the allopaths would use a lot of minerals. They would do bleedings and a lot of if you look at a lot of the old cartoons and editorials, it was really a philosophical battle between the two camps. Well, until you had the robber barons coming along, and what they did was they took over the empiricists, the homeopaths, by taking over the medical schools. You would have these medical schools, and you'd have, you know, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds coming along and saying, well, we're going to give you a lot of money. And since we've given you all this money, wouldn't it be prudent to let us sort of look at what you're doing and have some of our people, you know, participate in your administrations and your symposia and kind of let us have a further and more influential say in how you do things? And the whole effort was steered towards teaching physicians pharmaceutical drugs, which is how it all basically went towards. Pharmaceutical drugs. And you look at the foundations, and that's exactly what happened. And that's really, you have the empiricists, the homeopaths were pretty much shoved right off the stage. And that's what the you know, Big Pharma, for example, this facility I'm in now used to be owned by a pharmaceutical company, Pfizer.
Oh.
And the extravagance of the building just speaks to the incredible profits that these pharmaceutical companies make. And I'll give you an example. There is a chemotherapy drug called sunitinib, and its brand name is Sutent. It's made by Pfizer. A 1 month supply costs almost $7,000.
Well. You want to talk about propinquity?
Sure, let's talk about propinquity.
I don't know if I sent you this email about symbology.
I don't know if I got that.
All right, I'm looking at this right now because you talk about irony, but as you're stating this, The idea was that people were bringing about was, you know, the email group that we kind of do things with, and that is the symbology of occultism. And I think one of the things that was a sticking point was the Eye of Horus, okay?
Right.
And that truthfully has found itself a very warm and fuzzy home, and I'm bringing this up because you were talking about Pfizer. And Pfizer used that absolutely directly for its logo, all right? And that was the expanded, schematic, what we would call it schematic now, but in those days there was nothing schematic about it. It just wasn't really like multidimensional. It was the Eye of Horus. Can you visualize that?
Yes.
All right. There was a listener many years ago when I had my former manifestations of the show, whose father was an apothecary. And I say that not as a druggist, because you know what we've forgotten about, Eric, and that is the pistol and the mortar. The reason why that are emblematic signs now, although somewhat, I guess, vestigial, and that was because druggists would take prescriptions and they would tailor it to the person. You know what I mean? So you got individualized pharmaceutical help. But you don't get that. I mean, what do they do now? They just pill dispense. Okay?
Yes.
All right, be that as it may. Okay, so the whole idea, the Eye of Horus was Pfizer's logo. And they make the whole, you know, they go all through the symbology and explain it all away. And then you have, and I'm not even going to try to, you know, say this precisely, the Rod of Escapulus or whatever it is, which is the AMA cross with a snake entwined about it. Now, if you looked, if you gave that to a child and said, is this a good thing or a bad thing? What do you think a child would say? You know, get that thing away from me.
Yeah, kids instinctively know certain things.
Yeah, I mean, serpent, no, not good. Well, you know, this is because there was a certain healing power. You know, get it out of here. So my point about all this is, when it has to do with symbology and innuendo and trying to influence an entire people, I mean, take a look at the symbology and that's what you'll find. And so when you just brought up what you did, I just happened to get an email kicked up about this whole thing. And that is, no, listen, this is not good stuff. We don't like the symbology. We know it's not good. And yet it's found a place within our lives, which, by the way, I mean, my wife and I continually try to kick away, like, you know, some flames licking up at our feet as we're trying to get out of the, you know, the maelstrom.
There you go. Same with my wife and I. And here's another thing, Al,
all right,
that makes me absolutely do a slow burn. Why did Angelina Jolie go through, at least we're told, this disfiguring?
Double mastectomy?
Sacrificial, in a sense.
Yes, I know.
Double mastectomy. Why the frig did she not come out and talk about Laetril, the Hoxie formula? The extract of mistletoe, I can't think of the name off the top of my head. Of course, I can't when I wanted to. ECAC, so many different alternative formulas. She could have picked one. Why didn't she talk about Hoxie? But she talks about this other thing. You know, I look at my downtown East Lyme, and they did this quarter marathon that I mentioned, all the pink ribbons all over the place. By the way, they're originally salmon. The woman that started that started with salmon ribbons, and somehow they were taken over by this concern, and they became pink. But I just look at this, and I realize just how much influence these people have. And then, of course, I realize, okay, they're all puppets. They're controlled, but the tragedy to me is there's so much suffering happening here, and it doesn't have to freaking happen, Al.
No. No, it sends you everywhere else but where it really works. And, you know, I don't think you and I would interview about this, and I think I did it with somebody else, and you may have heard it, but about, I mean, Lorraine Day, for all her, you know, wrestly points and all that. I mean, when a woman says who had a tumor the size of her breast, she goes, why would I want to take chemo? A lack of chemo, you know, didn't give me cancer. Why do I want radiation? It wasn't a lack of radiation that gave me cancer. And why would I lop off a breast? It wasn't too many breasts that gave me that. Now, that's from a woman, okay? It's not from me. And, I mean, the point is that they, you know, the whole industry is not about curing. It's about masking systems and symptoms and keeping people going along, because unless they're not cha-chinging their pharmaceuticals up, well, then what is the pharmaceutical industry going to do? I mean,
that's a good question.
I mean, you
they're
know,
gonna, yeah, it's if people get well, their market goes away.
I tell you what, am I worried about martial law? No. Am I worried about, I don't know, like troops coming? I couldn't give a shit less. What bothers me is that I find, and I mean, we've articulated this probably off the show, and that is, get away from me with this, you know, edict about you have to have, you know, health care, even though you can't afford it. Are you serious? And, you know, these other elements that impinge upon me, it's like, hold on. You know, All right. I mean, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but here's what just strikes me so nastily, and that is at a time when people are losing their full-time jobs, when we know that there's all companies, especially corporations, going to part-time jobs, we'll give you 35 hours, we'll split your hours, which is another whole deal, but we're not going to give you any coverage. At this point in time, when more people are not covered and don't work for companies that give them coverage, now's the time you're going to tell people, if you don't have coverage, we're going to fine you. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, I'm banging my head against a cement wall saying, how in the world does this make any sense?
Well, isn't that line that Theo said really kind of apropos here? Insert your Twilight Zone soundtrack music. Because that's really what it should be.
And that is?
With this kind of news and this kind of scenario, we should be hearing the Twilight Zone theme song.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
You know, here's another example of, for example, with the cancer treatments. Laetril was Dr. Krebs, and Laetril is actually part of my diet. I can get apricot kernels. I can order them online.
Yeah, I eat them too, three a day, yep.
Okay, at least three a day. I eat those, and they are available online. And did you know that the bitter almond trees were banned in the United States in 1995?
Tell me the truth, Eric. How many do you eat a day?
7 to 9.
You do?
Yep.
Okay, that's good. As long as you didn't die, I'll do that. The reason we say that is because...
I eat them in my salads. They're right. In my salads.
All right. Yep. Just to tell people, I mean, what is it? Like, is there cyanide in there?
There is cyanide. It's amygdalin. It's called amygdalin. And it's kind of colloquially referred to as vitamin B17. And G. Edward Griffin did some good work on that. He wrote a book called World Without Cancer.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The Story of Vitamin B17. I have that book, and it's superb. And he's given some very good lectures. And, in fact, excerpts of the lecture are in the documentary Cancer, the Forbidden Cures.
He's been on. I had him on a long, long time ago to talk about the financial scam and all that.
Yeah.
But I know he did work on that as well.
Yes.
But go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that it sort of circles right back to, right back to our point of origin, that a lot of these suppressed inventions and cures have been done under the rubric of the Commerce Clause in the Constitution. It's sort of an aggregate clause. Well, if one person uses Laetril, then that means that everybody could use Laetril and it would affect the pharmaceutical market. If one person uses a water-powered car, then everybody could use a water-powered car and affect the oil industry. And there seems to be this aggregate principle that's used, and it's actually been, to some extent, buttressed by the courts. And it ties right into the Commerce Clause and how it's been used to control so many aspects of our lives right from the get-go.
Go.
So it's kind of the same reasoning that our elementary school teachers use on us. You know, if I let you do it, then I'd have to let everybody else do it. So, you know, if you look at this whole aggregation-based rationale, it's limitless. You know, you stop and think about it. The congressional power to control interstate
commerce,
it's been stretched so as to encompass just about everything and anything. You know, a farmer, he could grow and eat his own wheat, and he could be deemed to affect interstate commerce. And it's like I was saying earlier. You know, if millions of farmers would practice that practice, it would suppress the wheat market. And I was going to say that it's a beautiful example of, well, lawyers. How lawyers have just crept in to the structure of state and life and have eaten out our substance like termites.
But you see, would you not have, well, okay, this is a loaded like question I'm going to pose to you. Can you not see, and of course you can, that this has been allowed to happen? I mean, it's been a setup all along. You know,
yes.
I mean, that it's got government control doesn't mean anything. It only means that the bad guys can do stuff under an aegis of the government allowing it. I mean, when you look at government control, you're looking for them to create an even playing field, right? Whether it's got to do with agriculture or not. Let's just take agriculture. Everybody raises corn the same way, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? It's just
yes.
to make sure that everybody's playing fair. It's like a referee in a fight.
Yeah.
But what's happened is that those institutions charged with that kind of regulatory functions have been bought out and allowed the corporations to do what they will. It's about the bribery.
Well, the bribery is so rife as to be incomprehensible.
And so my point to you is, if you're okay with that, and I think you would be, that's the thing we're saying, is that the government's no longer a protection for us. Oh, they get up there in front of TV, and they go in when they want to, you know, run for office. They talk about, you know, all this kazinga. But the point is that they don't stop anything. They just let these characters go on. You know, the USDA doesn't do shit. And the FDA doesn't do shit. More people have been killed by USDA and FDA-sanctioned foods and drugs or whatever than anybody killed by homeopathy.
Well, it's the FDA that really submarined Hoxie. He was arrested. There was a guy named Al Templeton who was his prosecutor. Well, what happened was, with Hoxie, Al Templeton's brother Mike contracted cancer. Well, guess what he did? He saw Hoxie on the down low. Hoxie cured him. So Al Templeton is now, guess what? He's no longer Harry Hoxie's prosecutor. He's his attorney.
Jeez.
So what happened was, Hoxie, he used to carry, because he struck oil. The guy was rich. He was very wealthy. You know, he was an oil man, and he was publicized his clinics, and he would carry $10,000 around with him at all times, because Al Templeton, he was arrested more than 100 times. He was arrested more than just about anybody involved with a debate in the health care arena. Let me just put it that way. And what he would do is, sometimes he would stay in prison or he would stay in jail, and people that he cured would show up with pies, baskets of chicken, cakes. They would hang out and talk to him. They'd sing and pray. And it got to the point where it was so embarrassing for the courthouses and the cops that they'd have to let him go. He had so many supporters. What happened was, he was charged by the state of Texas at least twice. I have links to the cases themselves. And patient after patient after patient would testify on his behalf. And then there was this guy named Morris Fishbein. He was in charge of the AMA Journal.
Yeah, what a pit bull he was, yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, here's the irony. He actually originally trained. Did you know that this guy originally trained to be a clown?
I think I might have. All right, listen. No, what I'm going to tell you real quickly, okay, is that I wrote a small book, if you will, when I was in exile up in Vermont, that it disseminated amongst the Vermont Law School students, and it was called something, I don't know. But I used, as a nom de plume, Morris Fishbein.
what was the book called? I missed it.
I don't know, but I don't think I want to remember it.
Okay.
All right,
that's
so
great. Morris Fishbein was your nom de plume.
Yeah, and I didn't know what a kind of prick he was at the time, so please go ahead with this.
Well, what happened was, it was revealed, because he was attempting to shut Hoxie down, and he was in court, and he testified Basically, he had to admit that Hoxie, well, Hoxie had two methods. He had the external method and he had the internal method of curing cancer.
Whoops.
Okay, and what happened was Fishbein actually admitted on the stand, first of all, he admitted that he didn't finish, that he flunked anatomy and that he had never done any doctoring in his life. He'd never dealt with a patient in his life. That he basically went from medical school right to the directorship of the AMA journal. And he admitted on the stand that Hoxie's external cure did effectively cure melanomas. That was in the court testimony, that he actually had to admit it. And what he did was, this was slightly later, Hoxie ended up suing Fishbein and the Hearst newspapers, because what happened was Fishbein wrote an article called Blood Money about Hoxie. Well, Hoxie said, F you, I'm going to sue you. And he won. Well, he only won $2 in the settlement,
yeah,
but it was a very big victory for Hoxie, because Fishbein actually had to resign.
He had to back off, yeah.
He was completely disgraced.
Well, he was.
So there is a clinic. I'm sorry?
He was a disgrace.
Yeah, the guy was a piece of shit. You know, and he comes up with these statements, and of course the Hollywood machine was putting out some movies that are in the documentary that I'll send you a link, the link of which I'll send you. But there is a Hoxie clinic now in Tijuana. And his nurse? I can't remember her name, but she ended up taking the practice down to Tijuana in 1963. I think his last clinic was closed in 1960, if I remember right.
Huh? Okay.
But here you have somebody who's enjoying an 80% cure rate, and this is just one of at least a dozen alternate methods of dealing with cancer. And it seems to me, is when I look at the history of this, one of the methods that the courts have used to put the kibosh on these things, not just Hoxie but others, and that includes energy inventions that have been suppressed, is that magical little thing called the Commerce Clause.
Yeah.
And that's what the AMA used ultimately. I'm sorry, the FDA ultimately used the Interstate Commerce Clause to shut Harry Hoxie down, because he couldn't fight it on a state by state level. So he ended up just closing up his clinics, because the FDA just came in and padlocked his clinics. I believe it was in the 50s. I don't know if it was 50, it was in 60, or if it was in 58, somewhere around there. But the FDA came in and padlocked every one of them on the same day.
Mm-hmm. This makes more sense to me when I realized that the whole thing about nations have to do with business. I mean, have to do with just buying and selling. And,
yes,
you know, we think about countries as being, I don't know, what does one think? I mean, you know, I've asked this myself, and I have not come to like a clear vision of this. And maybe it's unfair to me to ask you, but even the listeners, when you talk about your country, what do you think about? Do you think about, you know, mountains and hills and whatever you see outside your window? Do you think about government? Do you think about people? When I talk about my nation, I think about my government. And I think my government sucks, because it does suck. You know, I mean, the bit about the landscape, well, okay, fine. I mean, that's not anything my government created. You know what I mean? So this bit about patriotism and, you know, wanting to, keep close to suckle the breast of one's country. I mean, give me a break. You know, and that's where I think we're all, you know, kind of like coming to some kind of critical mass, because – and this, you know, in a way does and doesn't do something with what you're talking about, and that is, what's patriotism? I mean, what really is patriotism? Are you trying to, like, con me? You know, I mean, but what you mentioned about the Commerce Clause, and what's so key about what you've done in this, you know, 90 minutes, and that is, it is prominent that all this is about, the creation of nations, is about business. It's all about business. You're taking that, Eric. I mean, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I mean, but what have you
got? No, you're not. You're certainly not, Al. It's when I think of my country and that, I hearken back to the stories of soldiers in the battlefield, where if you were to ask them, maybe when they first went and they had this idealized version of and view of war, they would say, well, I'm doing it for my country. And then you would probably ask them even a week or two into the battle, and they'd say, country, shit, I'm doing it for my fellow soldier who's next to me in the trenches.
Right.
And I kind of think of that, you know, with the country. I think of more of my a fellow citizen who's living in this country, maybe my neighbor, a fellow worker. It's gotten to the point where when I think of my country, I think of my country, my fellow country people. You know, that these are people that I'm going to maybe, you know, ask for help or help when the shit does finally hit the fan. Because make no mistake, people, we're heading into some very deep sneakers. We're heading into some times that are going to make these days look like the good old days. And at that point, are we going to be in the trenches, so to speak, next to each other, saying, it's not my country, it's the guy and gal next to me? I think it could very well happen.
We'll close out with this, because, I mean, you have no problem with me with, you know, what you just said. But for the purpose of this series that we're doing, and the last one that you did was very, very cogent, because it nailed right then and there. But that one particular, shall we say, pseudonymous or anonymous writer, that the United States was a forerunner of a federation of the world. Is that correct? I mean, are we okay
yes.
with that? What was his name?
Yes.
His pseudonym was a planter?
Sorry. Off the top of my head, I don't recall.
I think a planter was one of his...
Might have been a farmer and planter.
That's it. That's what it was. But,
okay.
I mean, to me, when we did that show, I was like, holy crap. I mean, he just nailed it right then and there. We know what this is about.
Yes.
All right, he's one person. Okay, so he's crazy. You know how this all goes with the bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get all past that kind of stuff. The point of the matter is, I think what we're all trying to bring people to some kind of recognizance of is that your government is not necessarily your advocate. Are we okay in saying that at this time especially? That all right.
Absolutely, totally.
Okay.
Can I read a very short excerpt from Federalist Paper, Anti-Federalist Paper number 3?
No, we have about 8 minutes. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize we had that much time. Good. Okay. This is from New Constitution Creates a National Government, Will Not Abate Foreign Influence, Dangers of Civil War and Despotism. Okay, this is like the nom de plume Publius used by pro-Constitution writers in the Federalist Papers. Several anti-Federalists signed their writings a farmer. While the occupation of the writers may not have coincided with the name given, the arguments against consolidating power in the hands of a central government were widely read. The following was published in the Maryland Gazette and Baltimore Advertiser, March 7, 1788. The true identity of the author is unknown. There are but two modes by which men are connected in society, the one which operates on individuals. This always has been and ought still to be called national government. The other which binds states and governments together, not corporations, for there is no considerable nation on earth, despotic, monarchical, or republican, that does not contain many subordinate corporations with various constitutions. This last has heretofore been denominated a league or confederacy. The term federalists is therefore improperly applied to themselves by the friends and supporters of the proposed Constitution. This abuse of language does not help the cause. Every degree of imposition serves only to irritate, but can never convince. They are national men, and their opponents, or at least a great majority of them, are federal, in the only true and strict sense of the word. Whether any form of national government is preferable for the Americans to a league or confederacy is a previous question we must first make up our minds upon. That a national government will add to the dignity and increase the splendor of the United States abroad can admit of no doubt. It is essentially requisite for both, that it will render government and officers of government more dignified at home is equally certain, that these objects are more suited to the manners, if not the genius and disposition of our people is, I fear, also true, that it is requisite in order to keep us at peace among ourselves is doubtful, that it is necessary to prevent foreigners from dividing us or interfering in our government, I deny positively, and after all, I have strong doubts whether all its advantages are not more specious than solid. We are vain, like other nations. We wish to make a noise in the world and feel hurt that Europeans are not so attentive to America in peace as they were to America in war. We are also no doubt desirous of cutting a figure in history. Should we not reflect that quiet is happiness, that content and pomp are incompatible? I have either read or heard this truth, which the Americans should never forget, that the silence of historians is the surest record of the happiness of a people. The Swiss have been 400 years the envy of mankind, and there is yet scarcely an history of their nation. What is history but a disgusting and painful detail of the butcheries of conquerors and the woeful calamities of the conquered? Many of us are proud and are frequently disappointed that office confers neither respect nor difference. No man of merit can ever be disgraced by office. A rogue in office may be feared in some governments. He will be respected in none. After all, what we call respect and difference only arise from contrast of situation, as most of our ideas come by comparison or relation. Where the people are free, there can be no great contrast or distinction among honest citizens in or out of office. In proportion as the people lose their freedom, every gradation of distinction between the governors and governed obtains until the former become masters and the latter become slaves. In all governments, virtue will command reverence. The divine Cato knew every Roman citizen by name and never assumed any preeminence, yet Cato found, and his memory will find, respect and reverence in the bosoms of mankind until this world returns into that nothing from whence omnipotence called it. And it goes on. It would go on for a while.
Whoa. Oh,
these guys and gals who wrote these anti-federalist papers were brilliant.
Prescient, honest, and done away with.
That's right. They were abused by the Federalists. The anti-Federalists were basically, they were beaten on like the proverbial redheaded stepchild, to the point where even the Federalists would, you know, buy out newspapers and bribe newspaper editors to not publish their stuff.
And yet people, you know, ask this all the time, and you've seen this in blogs, well, how can you keep a conspiracy that big quiet? Well, here's the way you do it, jerk.
Yeah, you were saying that in the email, which I thought was great. You nailed it.
Oh my God, I mean, are you kidding me? We've seen this time and time again, but I mean, be that as it may. But I mean, you know, people who keep yakking about this, about how can you keep a conspiracy? Look, if that's a linchpin that's keeping you from understanding what's going on, then come on and talk to us, because we will tell you. Because there are plenty of people that are recording in time who have said, hey, man, what you guys, you know, are dealing with did not go down that way. And, you know, and so that's how it goes. So, I mean, it's a thankless job, without a doubt. And, again, you thought of as, like, being unpatriotic. Well, what does that mean? If we're into a period where it's our country right or wrong, you can kiss my purple ass, and that's the end of it.
It's like I said before, Al. The more I study what our two go-to guys, the Montgomery and the Informer, Stud was right on, was bang on the money, because it's like I said it before, I'll say it again, it's all checked out.
No, and they didn't make a big deal about it. I mean, they just did their work, and it's like, you know, here it is, you know, we fell upon it, and we found true, but you know what?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Johnny-come-lately, but, you know, I have no problem verifying stuff that's worth verifying.
Nope, I feel the same way. All right, look, you've gone over time. I appreciate it. We will see you probably pretty soon. But you came loaded for bear, and I got an idea that you did not necessarily share with us all that you have also in your bag of tricks.
I have mucho more, Al.
Okay. So we'll see you on the other side of the show.
Sounds like a plan.